Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
What kind of diplomacy, JD, you are speaking about? What do you mean?
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Do you disagree that you've had problems bringing people into your military?
We have problems.
And do you think that it's respectful to come to the Oval Office of the United States of America and attack the administration that is trying to prevent the destruction of your country?
First of all, during the war, everybody has problems. Even you, but you have nice ocean and don't feel now, but you will feel it in the future. God bless you, you will not have a war.
Don't tell us what we're going to feel. We're trying to solve a problem. Don't tell us what we're going to feel.
I'm not telling you.
Because
I'm
you're in no position to dictate that.
That's
remember
exactly
this.
What
you're,
not dictating.
You're in no position to dictate what we're going to feel. You've allowed
from
yourself to be in a very bad
very
position, and he happens
war.
To be right about
from
it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not
Mr.
in a good position.
I don't have
the cards right now. With us, you start having
not
cards.
Playing cards.
Right now, you
I'm
don't have
serious,
you're playing
serious,
cards.
Mr. President.
You're playing
I'm very
cards.
Serious.
You're gambling
I'm
with the lives of
war.
Millions of people.
You think
you're gambling
you
with World War III. Your country's in big trouble.
Can I answer?
Wait a minute. No, no. You've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning.
I know.
You're not winning this. It's going to be a very hard thing to do business like this.
Again,
I tell you.
Just say thank you.
I
accept,
said a lot of times thank you to
that,
American people.
Accept that there are disagreements, and let's go litigate those disagreements rather than trying to fight it out in the American media when you're wrong.
The problem is I've empowered you to be a tough guy. You're either going to make a deal or we're out.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green Red Podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California today. And as always, I am joined by...
Bob Bazanko, feeling scrappy here in Houston, Texas.
At the beginning of this episode, we just played a clip from a press conference today with Trump and Vance and Volodymyr Zelensky. I think Hegseth is in there too. As a good... opener for the stuff that we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the military industrial complex. We're going to talk about the anniversary of the war in Ukraine, and we're going to talk about Doge and the Pentagon and a couple of other things.
Yeah, it was 3 years. What was it? Yesterday or the day before, we actually did a show on this as the war was either it just like that day Russia had crossed the border the day after something. And we had said at the time, this is a bad idea. Everybody was flying their Ukraine flags and everything like that. And as we predicted, it's become a bloody standstill, a mess, and the situation hasn't really resolved itself. So we'll talk about that. But that clip is really pretty remarkable. As somebody who's studied presidential kind of press conferences and presidential statements and diplomacy my entire career, that's a new one where you have the president of a sovereign country and the vice president of the United States getting in a pissing match, right? Have you said thank you once, Vance House, an upset spouse or something like that? You don't respect me. You never thank me for anything kind of thing. And then Zelensky throws back at him. You think if you talk loudly, you get away with it. And then Trump intervenes to defend Vance. And it's truly humiliating when Trump later says, you have no leverage. You can't win this one. This is public diplomacy. Yeah. So it's crazy.
It's like a bad episode of The Apprentice or something.
Yeah. So we had been against this from the beginning and not out of any kind of, just like they were, just like it's come, it came around in 23 that like everyone who criticized Israel became anti-Semitic. In the early phases of that, how many times were we called like Putin's bitches and stuff like that? So you couldn't criticize that war unless without being attacked as being pro-Putin or something like that. And now 80% of Americans say it's time to get out. It's time to end it. Which is what we were saying, along with a lot of other people back in early 2022. And then today's exchange brings it all home. What a freaking disaster this has been. Now, you and I think probably feel the same way about Volodymyr Zelensky. We don't consider him the new Churchill or anything like that.
Yeah.
Pretty much the way a lot of critical people have described him is, I believe, accurate, right? But I do think there's something here that is telling. And it reminded me long ago when I first started doing what I do, studying, especially the Vietnam War, talking to a lot of people. And when I came to Houston too, I talked to a lot of Vietnamese refugees. And one thing that they often said was, you guys set us up, right? You talked us into this war. You sent all these equipment over. You sent all this money over. You built up an army. You sent troops over. You sent advisors over. And then you just bailed on us when it became too much and you left us, right? And as much as I oppose the Vietnam War, they're right. I think they're right. And I think we're seeing that now, right? I do believe that Biden and his administration promised Zelensky the world, and they created this kind of media spectacle around him. And then they didn't really provide what he needed, if that was even possible. And then Trump comes in and pulls the rug out. This is actually the way that empires work. And it's, I get they're being upset about it. Obviously, Russia is not in any way an anti-imperial or democratic place or anything like that. So what I thought we'd do is talk a little bit about what the war has meant. We're getting, perhaps, I'm assuming, close to the end. And when it started, we made certain predictions about losses and costs, just not with numbers, but we knew it would be bad at the social milieu there. And so I think we can talk about that now. I'll start just with something that I think is at the core of everything. And it was at the core of what we said when we started talking about this. And we said, the war is going to be bloody. And a lot of people are going to get killed. A lot of people are going to get hurt. A lot of civilians are going to get hurt. A lot of neighborhoods are going to get blown up. And it's not going to be the people who run those countries. It's going to be the workers of those countries, the peasants and things like that. And we've seen that. So just a little bit on number of casualties, number killed, right? And this is as of pretty much now. And these are estimates, probably close, if not very accurate. So to begin, even before the 2022 invasion, remember, we talked about this on the first time we were did this show. Between 2014 and 2022, there was actually fighting in the Donbass region. And in that 8-year period, you already had about 14 or 15,000 people killed in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Right? So it had begun. So the numbers we have and their estimates began in February of 2022. So we're talking about 3 years. And I've said this before because we did shows. We've done a lot of shows on this. We haven't done one in a while. And in one of them, I pointed out that the number of people killed and wounded in Ukraine and among Russian soldiers are far, far exceeded anything that we saw in Vietnam. And in Vietnam, you're talking about a 7 or 10 year, however you want to gauge it, ground war. And in Ukraine, it was like a year or two, and they'd already exceeded the losses in the Vietnam era, right? The total casualties, and that's both killed and wounded, in the last 3 years is probably north of 1 million. It seems pretty likely. And I've looked at data from U.S. sources, from The Economist, from journalists and so on, right? In June of 2024, so this is 6 months ago, The Economist estimated that Russia had lost between 460,000 and 730,000. That's wounded and killed combined. The estimates for Ukraine were about 12,000 civilians killed, because most of the war's in Ukraine, right? Almost all the whole war's in Ukraine, basically. Ukraine lost 12,000 or more civilians and about 30,000 wounded. Forces lost, obviously, is much bigger. So Ukraine, the estimates are that they had 60 to 100,000 killed, right? In Vietnam, the United States lost 58,000. So Ukraine would already have exceeded that. So 50 to 100,000 killed and about 400,000 wounded.
Yes. Generally, it's a smaller country than the United States was in the year or whatever.
Yeah. And Russia, the estimates are 200,000 killed and about 600,000 wounded. So you're looking probably total in excess of 1 million. So it is an immense loss of human life. And I think that's anything like that starts, right? I keep going back to Debs' famous speech over 100 years ago. The master class declares all the wars, and the working class, right? The subject class fights all the battles, and that's clearly who's losing their lives, right? We also have some data on economic costs. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the U.S. estimates that the Russians have lost about $211 billion. On the Ukraine side, the U.S. has sent $175 billion to Ukraine, which obviously Zelensky is not very grateful, as we found out today. Since February 2022, a lot of that aid money was actually spent in the U.S. because
it's important.
Yeah, there's programs that they have within the Pentagon where they pay, and we did shows on this back around the beginning of the war. I'm going to talk a little bit about this here in a few minutes, but they have programs within the Pentagon where the Department of Defense pays Lockheed Martin a bunch of money for weapons, and then they get shipped to Ukraine, or they get shipped to Israel, or where have you.
Just let me cut in for a second there, because the current Trump attack on spending, right? And he's going after all these programs. I don't know if he understands, that's how aid works. Military aid, foreign aid, like they give you money and then you purchase stuff back. They're called offset arrangements, right? And so the point is you're subsidizing your own businesses. So I give you money, but then you're compelled to purchase goods and services back from me. The idea that people are throwing money abroad, throwing money away, it's just, that's not the way this system works. First of all, the U.S. spends way less in foreign aid than Americans understand. And it's not just tossing money into the wind, but that's really critical here. Ukraine has spent a lot of money purchasing goods back from American companies.
Yeah. In U.S. aid.
Yeah.
In 2022, we saw $13 billion and $40 billion spent between the Ukrainians and the Americans, respectively.
Yeah.
In 2023, it's $12 billion and $47 billion. In 2024, it's $61
billion. Yeah.
And this is actually there's a pretty important thing to note here. One is the way in which these offsetting works, that, like Bob just said, is like, this is profit in the pocket of U.S. weapons manufacturers. The U.S. corporations, most weapons manufacturers are U.S. corporations. There's European weapons manufacturers, and there's weapons manufacturers in other parts of the world. But for all intents and purposes, the U.S. is the biggest arms dealer in the world. So that's actually really important. And so when our Congress, is Congress who actually has control over the budget, not the executive, contrary to what Elon and Don tell us.
As of today, maybe, but you never know.
Yeah, that could be changing before we know it. But when Congress approves the budget and allocates money to military aid to Ukraine or where have you, they're basically paying that to these arms dealers, which are largely U.S. Very important to note. The other thing here is that when that military aid is being allocated to go fight wars in Gaza or Ukraine, it's not money that's going to places that are in crisis in the U.S. Let's talk about East Palestine, Ohio. Let's talk about Jackson, Mississippi. Let's talk about Flint, Michigan. And those are just some of the worst sort of environmental injustice cases that we could talk about. But people, we're moving into this new measles in Texas. It's the latest, right? And so that is not money that's going back into like domestic coffers to support Americans who are actually in dire straits. I'll get into this a little bit more. They do want to I think they're calling it reinvestment at this point. I think Hegseth put a memo out about it, but they're calling it reinvestment. And so what they want to do with some of this money, they're not actually really going to cut it. They're going to reinvest it into other military operations. Border security is going to be a top one. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, though.
Yeah, I think
so. Let's just stay on Ukraine for a second.
Yeah, and as an aside, I think that's an important point, because the way foreign aid programs are structured, and historically it's been this way, you can look at like the Marshall Plan or the creation of the IMF and World Bank or NSC 68, right? At the time, one of the big concerns was that the world after the Depression, after World War II, wasn't in any condition to buy stuff. It didn't have, there was a so-called dollar gap. These other countries didn't have dollars, so they couldn't buy stuff. The American aid programs were intended for that purpose. They're essentially subsidies, right? So you send all this money, massive amounts of money, especially to Europe and things like the Marshall Plan or with the Bretton Woods system or later in NSC 68. And then they purchase goods back, right? And so that way I'm guaranteed economic activity to avoid what had happened in the 1920s after World War I, another depression, right? So I'm guaranteed that. But I'm also creating allies and friends and outposts elsewhere. And that's what the U.S. did, right? What's really striking about this is the United States is at odds now with the British and the French, who continue to insist that Europe is important, that NATO is important. And as a good lefty, I've never been an advocate of NATO. I don't think it has a purpose. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But those kind of arrangements are important. These aren't charity works, right? And even if you take programs, like you mentioned USAID, right? And I've seen a lot of lefties attacking USAID. I'm glad he got rid of it. And I know I've studied this. This is an element of soft power, right? But one part of soft power means that you actually provide resources for people in these communities. You can build schools or clinics or whatever. So it's doing that as well.
I will say, when I said USAID, I was just talking about just in a more general term, not actually.
No, I know, but I'm thinking like the bigger point here is that people don't understand the way aid works, because no one's ever explained it. No one has an interest in explaining the way it works, right? Yeah. I've seen polls my whole life where they'll say, does the U.S. spend too much on foreign aid? And the majority of Americans will say, yes, we spend too much on foreign aid. And then they'll say, what does the U.S. spend? What percentage of GDP does the U.S. spend on foreign aid? And people will say, oh, it's probably around 20%. And then they'll say, what should the U.S. spend on foreign aid? And people will say, oh, 8, 10%. The reality is it's about 2%. So what they think it is, but it's also much lower than what they think it should be. And so I think it's important to understand how these work. Like, I'm not an advocate of the United States spending billions in Ukraine. There are a million places, literally, I think, that would have been better to spend that money, places where it'd be better to spend that money. But at the same time, it wasn't just like the United States was sending money, throwing it up in the sky. It was used to purchase goods back. It was used to invigorate certain companies, especially military industrial companies, right? Also, but before we move on, the UN not long ago did a report on Ukraine, what had happened there, the damages there. And it's pretty stark, right? They estimate that the cost of rebuilding Ukraine will be over $500 billion, over $500 billion to rebuild Ukraine. The direct damage is already close to $200 billion there. 13% of all the housing stock in Ukraine has been destroyed. Blah. What's interesting, of course, is like that $500 billion in reconstruction, who do you think is going to be getting that money?
U.S. and other Western European.
Halliburton, Schlumberger, GM.
Right.
Ford, General Electric, who knows? Is Europe safe for now? Obviously not. And there's always going to be this debate going on too, which we've talked about it'll never be settled, about the role that U.S. and NATO played in starting the war. And liberals have always dismissed it and said, no, it had absolutely nothing to do with it. We disagree. At the same time, I personally believe Putin invaded Ukraine. I don't have any problem saying that. I think according to international law, he was an aggressor. And I think I've never been into the Russian conspiracy stuff, but you got to think Trump really does try to smooth things for Putin. So who knows what that's about.
PP videos.
Anyways, we could go on and on, but I think just to go back, because it's been 3 years, things may be finally winding down. Trump is really squeezing Zelensky, obviously wants mineral rights and all that, which is the way foreign policy works. It's usually you just do it on the side. You keep it more secretive. You don't do it out in the open. Nor do you have press conferences where your vice president and that head of another country get into name calling.
It's also worth noting one of the reasons that Zelensky had gone to Washington today is that in order for aid to continue and for the U.S. to be, for the Trump administration to be more of an ally to Zelensky, is that he was actually going to sign an agreement, sign away a lot of his mineral rights to the U.S., which actually he stormed out of the meeting before he signed it. But it's also like worth noting, as we're talking about, a lot of people are going to make a lot of money from the reconstruction of Ukraine. But it's also worth noting that I'm sure that Trump somehow set up one of his businesses to broker the deal. And I'm sure he'll get huge fees.
Absolutely. Those mineral rights are not going to the American Treasury. They're not going to the National Treasury.
They're
going
to go to the Trump organization.
Yeah, they're going to cronies. Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. It's, didn't we say this show the other day? In 1893, Sanford Dole became the governor of Hawaii, right? That's American foreign policy, right? Trump's whole thing about making America great again is like making him and a few of his billionaire oligarch friends great again.
So the story of the sort of Trump meme that sold for like record profit, like around the inauguration, and all of these Bitcoin people, I guess it was Trump Bitcoin, and all of these Bitcoin traders bought it because it was going to be worth so much. And then it plummeted and all those guys took a bath, except for a few like well-placed Bitcoin traders who really knew what was going on. But the Trump organization actually had brokered it and actually just charged fees. They actually didn't buy it or sell it. And they actually made something like $100 million from that. And everything that he does, everything that his family and his company are involved with, is only there to make more money, to personally enrich themselves.
Yeah.
And it's really clear that Elon has actually also knows that game too. And that's actually why he's also in the mix here. He gave $250 billion to the Trump campaign in 2024, and he's exponentially getting that investment back.
Yeah. He's had 30 some investigations already canceled into Tesla and SpaceX and so on. It is amazing. I mean, part of me thinks like, how do people fall for Trump? It's so seems to me obviously like artificially disingenuous. The Democrats never called him out on this. Like when he says that crazy shit, they never called him out. The media never called him out. So they continue to let these things stand and they get out in the atmosphere. People believe it. But yeah, this is all about him and his, a few of his friends getting rich. That's the whole point of this. And it's crazy too. I think we're about ready to segue to talk a little bit more about military stuff. And I know this morning I was chatting with a friend of mine who's a vet. I believe he was in maybe Iraq in the second Gulf. Not sure, but I think so. He's very upset today because of what Trump's going after vets, right? He's cutting back programs that help vets, counseling, mental health programs, VA programs. He's creating this, he's going to purge transgender people. My friend today said, I was in my unit. We had transgender, we had men, we had women. He's like, the CO said, you're here to do your thing. I don't care what you do on your own time or whatever. So he's very upset about that. So it's interesting. Trump is engaged in this frontal assault on institutions like military, which nobody would ever touch, right? He calls them suckers, losers, and he's cutting their budgets and all that kind of stuff. And he's fired the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who happens to be African-American. And was it the Air Force?
Maybe. It was the top admiral.
There's the admiral who's happens to be a woman, right? And everything is about DEI and woke. It's pretty screwed up. And one thing that we said in the past, and it's become a big story now, and I just like to point out, because I'm not a humble or a modest guy, that we've been talking about this for forever, right? Because I'm seeing all these stories from these various esteemed people talking about the ruling classes against Trump and the military and Trump and the working and Wall Street and Trump. I say, oh, yeah, there have a couple of people have been talking about that for 6-8 years now. But as soon as somebody from New York writes it, it's the most brilliant fucking thing ever, at any rate. But that's that. I think that's still an issue, right? I think that there are people out there who are deeply concerned about him. And I think the real question will be whether they continue to capitulate or whether at some point they say, okay, you're destabilizing everything. Joe Biden had to pardon Mark Milley because Trump was going to come after him. And Trump removed his security clearance and he took Secret Service protections away from people. He's on this real...
Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, actually under Trump, pulled his security detail too.
Yeah. And he was like Trump's guy, right?
Yeah.
Well, Pompeo as well. Didn't he pull Pompeo's also?
He also pulled Pompeo's security.
They both didn't, I know, but Pompeo, I don't know what the hell that's about. At any rate, but I think that's worth noting. I think what's happening in the Pentagon is really the media should be paying way more attention because it's not good. You fire the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the head of the Navy. He's the commander in chief. He can do that. He can replace people. But to do it, sure, for the reasons that he did, which he's been very clear, hasn't he? Admit he was upset at who's the head of the Joint Chief? Brown. His name Charles Brown?
Yeah. Is that Charles it? C. Brown.
Charles Brown. Yeah. And he said, because I remember in 2020, Brown posted this very eloquent, pain, heartfelt statement about being black in the military and how hard it was. And Trump held that against him. So he's made it clear he's firing this guy for racial reasons, which, you know, really isn't legal, right?
But they obviously couldn't find anyone who was going to be loyal to Trump amongst the four stars. They've had the person they've appointed to be the chair of the Joint Chiefs is a 3-star.
Who's a nobody. But
I'm sure he's like big Trumper.
Oh, yeah. No, he has pictures of himself with MAGA hats on and shit, which actually is a violation of military code.
Right.
You're not supposed to do that kind of thing. So I'm curious because, you know, the military on one hand has great power. And, you know, I've studied civil military relations. They can monkey wrench the system, right? According to the conspiracy people, it was the military who didn't like JFK and killed him. Rally, obviously, is very different. That wasn't the case at all. Actually, the military didn't want to get into the Vietnam War. There's the revolt of the admirals in the Truman era. So military is deeply involved in politics, always has been, always will be. They cultivate people in the media and so on. I'd be interested to see, though, but they also, they're deferential, right? They believe in military codes and you obey and you go up the chain of command. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out because they fired people at the highest level, the brass. They're also getting rid of JAGs and a lot of other folks too. Clearly, he's trying to create a military, almost like a Latin American military from the 60s or 70s, right?
And Hegseth is real fond of quoting about the reason he got rid of Brown and the reason he got rid of the top Navy admiral is that he wants to bring back a warrior culture. And he doesn't feel like the people who were gained their positions of power through DEI really support like a warrior culture. And that's his thing. That's why he's waging this war of DEI on the military, war against DEI in the military.
had an alcoholic rapist, right?
Yeah, white nationalist tattoos.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy shit. I'm curious. Hegseth obviously is not well respected. That's clear. A lot of Trump's people, like Flynn, wasn't well respected. The new chair, these guys weren't coming there with a great military. It's a big institution, right? You can't get rid of everybody. So a lot of those people, I would assume, are not there because they're MAGA people, right? And they're going to know that the chair of the Joint Chiefs is there because he is loyal to Trump. So it's just interesting how that plays out. Will they?
When you say that there's a, with the military, there's a military class, is that it's developed into a sort of, it's beyond an institution. It's like a sort of like cultural phenomenon,
yeah.
Like a class where they're well-educated. Many of them go on to serve on corporate boards afterwards, after they hit it big or what have you. And it's interesting to see Trump and Hegseth begin to wage war against the existing military class.
Yeah, it's strange. You know, the whole thing about warriors, that's a product of the 60s, because in that era, you started hearing people complain that the military had moved away from warriors and they were now looking for managers. And there was actually one of the better books on Vietnam was called The War Managers. Now, instead of back in the World War II generation, you worked your way up and you got promoted by being involved in D-Day or being in the 82nd Airborne, being in the 101st or something like that. Matthew Ridgway, Jimmy Gap, or like that. Beginning in the 60s, you started to see people who were like, instead of doing that, Westmoreland got an MBA, I think at Harvard. Earl Wheeler was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for most of the early Vietnam years. People used to make fun of him and say, he's never seen a shot fired in anger. He went to grad school. So that's when you saw this transition. It's over 50 years.
And McNamara, who was was the government manager, corporate, goes from corporate America to managing a huge institution.
With the WizKids, with the... And
right.
It's funny because I don't want to carry this too far, but McNamara has an Elon Musk role back then to bring the principles of business of corporate America to government, but obviously not like Musk or anything like that. But yeah, so this has been going on. So when Hegseth says this now, like, what the hell does that mean? Wars aren't really bought. Wars are fought like by drones and computers and freaking shit now.
30,000 feet dropping bombs, yeah, laser guided bombs.
I'm curious though, because Milley actually was outspoken when he was chair of the Joint Chiefs, and that's what pissed Trump off. So I'm curious as to whether there will be people in the military doing that. I wonder if you're going to start seeing. I think already I read that they're having trouble getting people to reenlist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I may have read that. I'm curious because the military is 40% of the military is not white. It's female. There are plenty of African-Americans and Latinos in the military. So it's a different, these aren't like county sheriffs, you know, a bunch of white, really conservative guys, right?
Hegseth also just discharged like 15,000 people who identify as trans too.
15,000?
Yeah, and some huge number like that. I was a little bit surprised at the large
numbers. Hard to believe. 15 billion? 15,000? That's a lot. I wonder if you made that up because they make shit up. But even and the thing is too, is like, the government invests a lot of money in training people. People get skilled and you're just throwing them away. You know how I feel about the military. It's so bizarre, right? Many of those people they've dismissed probably are fantastic soldiers, right? And you just got rid of them because of who they love, basically, who they want to be or who they love, right? You're keeping people in there who could get your whole fucking platoon blown up and killed because they're idiots. But I'm curious to see what happens going forward, especially after the firings and getting rid of the judge advocate general and all that kind of stuff. Remember the first term Trump pardoned that guy who was convicted of war crimes was in Afghanistan or Iraq?
It was Iraq. And Hegseth advised him to do it.
Yeah, Hegseth was leading that crusade. And the military, the active duty military, was pissed off about that. They didn't want that to happen. A lot of people give me, what kind of left you? I've been around a lot of military people, and I don't think they're inherently our allies, but it's different. It's a different culture than, say, police. Police are just, I've never met a cop, I think it's like, reachable, let's say that. It's hard to reach a cop and say, hey, you should rethink what you're doing. We both have tons of people who are in the military. We learned a good lesson from what they've seen there.
Yeah, I think it's good lefties being students of institutions is important. That's one of the best institutions in the world. I think understanding the complexity of it and that we've had anti-capitalist, anti-war vets on the show with us. We're friends with many of them. There's whole organizations which have resisted the state, which were made up of military vets. It's no lefty should be discarding.
My academic career is based on that.
We should be learning and studying about it and understanding the complexity and how we can use it to our advantage if we're wanting to change things.
I mean, every lefty knows who Smedley Butler is, and they quote him approvingly. There's a lot more than Smedley Butler out there doing that.
Exactly.
And I think that's important. I think it's also telling, and I know you want to talk a little bit about military spending and defense spending, right? Just the last thing I'll say, because when we talk about the military, this is a common theme. We also talk about the ruling class, right? And it's also interesting because you're seeing a lot more stories now about Wall Street being upset, being concerned with Trump. Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Forbes, you're starting to see a pretty big drumbeat. And it comes, and this is, again, something we've talked about for fucking forever, right? And again, they're making the very profound and brilliant and never before heard claim that Trump is destabilizing the global economy, which is something we've heard. And that's true. So I think that's something worth monitoring too, worth, you know, kind of auditing, right? However, are these people just going to sit back? And remember, was it Paulson or no, it was Lloyd Blankfein's famous line in 2017. He said, we went along with them because of the tax cuts. And after that, we made a deal with the devil, right? What are they going to do this time? Are they going to continue to do that? Because he's already, like, the new budget, right, has $2.8 trillion in tax cuts, I think, or some insane amount like that. Or cutting Medicaid, cutting Medicare, cutting kids' programs, cutting cancer research to give a $2.8 trillion tax, right?
He's going to take us back to the greasiest economy since 1880.
The Gilded Age.
That's what they want. I guess they see Gilded Age as a pejorative, so they're calling it the Golden Age, the Trump Golden Age. They literally go around and say that.
What neoliberals do? That was a neoliberal period, wasn't it? The 1880s. That when neoliberalism got started.
Yeah, yeah. I think so.
And then with the McKinley era,
those protective tariffs were is a manifestation of neoliberalism, right?
Yeah. Anyway, so there's a lot to monitor there. The situation is pretty bad, and it's alarming in a lot of ways. And obviously, the Democratic Party is not going to stand in the way. They're not going to take a bullet for anybody. So I think it'll be interesting to see like how these institutions, and forget the media, right, after what we've just seen with Bezos and just the overwhelming capitulation to him, and he's intimidated. They're giving him money because he's threatening to sue them. It's pretty scary. It's pretty bad, right? It's hard to even claim. You don't really deserve a free press when you fucking act that way. It's pretty bad.
Just to shift into some of the budget stuff and some of the corporate weapons manufacturer stuff. I just want to note that where they're going at the Pentagon around DEI, they're also going at it from the side of where they're going after lots of other agencies within the U.S. government, which is around government efficiency. With the Pentagon budget cuts, it's much more smoke than mirrors. Is the Washington Post actually had a recent headline that says Trump administration orders Pentagon to plan for sweeping budget cuts. But if you go and actually look at the actual order, it's actually shifting funding from some military programs into others. It's actually reshuffling the Pentagon budget, not cutting it. And so worth noting. And then the Pentagon, in a statement, Hegseth's office on February 20th, said that the Pentagon would rely on DOGE to find fraud, waste, and abuse in the largest discretionary budget in the federal government. But then he added, such cutting allows us to reinvest elsewhere. Right? Really important nuance in the words in which they're using there. And so what they are going to be cutting, which is going to be something like 8%, is going to come from non-lethal programs. And that money will flow toward the America First priorities of Trump, which include a military buildup at the border with Mexico, accelerated militarization of the Indo-Pacific region. And then this is my favorite. They're going to build an iron dome over America. Have you heard about this? Basically,
it's actually in the budget.
Those are the three priorities for the Pentagon budget. It's a throwback to Star Wars, I guess you could say, the Reagan era.
That's exactly what I thought. Yeah. The iron dome is reminiscent of that. Yeah.
But
they can use that old commercial with the little girl drawing with the crayons. The missile hits the.
I also want to say, amidst all of these budget cuts, Trump endorsed a Republican budget resolution, which passed the House this week, that includes an extra $100 million more in the Pentagon's budget. Where's government efficiency there, Bob?
Yeah, it's like over 900 officially, like the official budget. The real budget is over a trillion, but officially it's getting close now. It's 938 maybe or something like that billion. It's pretty freaking big.
Yeah. 100 billion more coming from Trump.
Yeah.
And despite all these budget cuts, it's the sort of thing that would maybe make stocks plummet within the weapons manufacturers, the S&P Aerosmith, Aerospace and Defense Select Industry Index, which is actually an index which represents the arms industry, is actually up 4% since Trump's election, and it's up 20% since last February. So it's really the, you can also, if you're gauging by the markets, if the markets are any indicator, they're actually feeling like pretty confident about what's happening. Executives at a number of war manufacturers, including L3Harris, Palantir, and Northrop Grumman have all said on recent calls that DOGE, President Trump's focus on efficiency, either aligned with aspects of their businesses or otherwise had some praise for those initiatives. Lockheed Martin CEO, who made a lot of money since Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the Israeli invasion of Gaza, called DOGE an opportunity to help streamline the acquisition process. And so William Hartung, who we actually had on the show, said in a recent article, getting rid of waste, whether it involves price gouging, access bureaucracy, or simple failure to keep track of the department's assets, is a worthwhile mission. But the real path towards making America more secure, a lower cost, must involve a genuine reevaluation of the nation's strategic goals that moves away from a primary emphasis on military instruments of statecraft towards more balanced approach that elevates diplomacy, cooperation, economic and cultural engagement, which actually they did not do with Zelensky today, and they probably won't be doing anytime soon. But
that's what USA groups like that do.
Yeah, you know? It's like soft imperialism. It's versus military force.
Power, which I hate to sound like an advocate of that, considering you have a guy threatening Greenland and Panama. I think one thing you're going to see too, because you mentioned that the kind of reallocating resources, you're going to see a lot more focus on Latin America. I think they're going back to the days of Monroeism almost, right? Because you're seeing this kind of like attack on Venezuela and Mexico, where he's threatening to send American troops in to fight the drug war, which is just like just the whole region. I think like kind of pink tide. He's invited Bolsonaro to the inaugural, and he's good friends with Milei in Argentina, right? I think you're going to see a renewed focus and a lot more resources poured into that region as well. Yeah.
I should also note that as we're talking about military contractors, one of the biggest recipients of military contracts, one of the biggest beneficiaries of this is Elon Musk. SpaceX in the last year got $3.3 billion in unclassified revenue. 2021, and this is under Biden, he won a $1.8 billion deal to build a network of spy satellites for an agency. So it's just Starlink. He's one of the biggest beneficiaries of this, which is all the more reason for him to be involved here.
Exactly. And that's the whole point of all this. It's not that actually Pentagon spending, it would be easy. It wouldn't be that hard to cut because it's done. Much of it's done publicly. It wouldn't be that hard to target certain areas and say, oh, we can cut that, we can cut that. The fact is, it's not hard. Right? But they're not going after any of those things. They're not going after the suppliers and the arms manufacturers and all that. They're going after people, and which is not the issue. You're spending billions of dollars on helicopters and aircraft and God knows, an Iron Dome, which is just insane and doesn't work either, really. Yeah. But yeah, the whole point of DOGE is not about efficiency. This is the kind of, you've heard this before, right? Bill Clinton came into office talking about this, and everybody does, right? It's a way to fatten up your cronies even more and get kickbacks from them. That's all this is about. It's not saving anybody any money. Every fucking thing they talk about is DEI now, and woke, and all this. And it's just crazy and frustrating.
Disturbing.
But I mean, it's Ukraine war is coming to an end. I think that's great, just because we've seen, who knows, hundreds of thousands of people killed, maybe 300,000-400,000, who knows, perhaps a million total casualties. That's just a bloodbath. And there are people who are not really invested in society. They're not part of the wealthy class or anything like that. They're working people, they're civilians. Their homes have been destroyed. They're facing just a massive reconstruction effort. And it's like the end of war is this often unleashes social forces. You'll probably see a lot of vets, both Russian and Ukrainian, who become like right-wing neo-Nazis in Europe. You know, it's just, you know, families are unsettled, increases and things like alcoholism and family abuse, stuff like that. So these things like destroy entire societies.
Yeah, it's...
And, you know, That's what we said when it started. And not like we're profoundly smart. It just like, wasn't that hard to figure out. There were a lot of people saying this in 2022. Right.
I think it's
obviously Ukraine in the Trump, the second Trump era is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
Who knows what Russia feels like it's going to be empowered to do now that like the US is likely going to pull back most of its aid or all of its aid at this point. Who knows what Putin's going to feel like he's empowered to do. European allies could put boots on the ground in Ukraine, which is a pretty dangerous thing. And then there's already all these people, over a million people have died or been maimed through this. And then the other part here is that once a peace deal is negotiated, Trump's going to take credit for it. And then he's also going to probably stand to profit a lot from it. And so it's just, there's no good outcomes at this point.
No, and I laid the groundwork. To some degree, I agree. Biden's not there anymore with beyond it, but it's the gift that keeps on giving, right? The guy, this is his baby, both of them. What gets me is you could see what was happening, right? You could see Ukraine was a bloodbath. Something else that's really important, and we're seeing this now with regard to Israel because of the ceasefire there, right? In both cases, there were like frameworks for a ceasefire in place really quickly, in fact. And the various parties involved, like Putin and Zelensky agreed in, what was that, March, like barely a month in 2022. And Boris Johnson had they scuttled it. The interview we did with Chomsky right after that, he brought it up, right? And the media didn't talk about it much. And what we've seen since then is several different types of reaffirmation of it, like confirmation of it, right? I think the head of one of the parties in the Ukrainian Congress said it was true. And then like people at fairly high level, that the president of Israel, was it? I forget it, Herzog maybe, or just said yes, I forget it. But the point is, this has been confirmed. And in the same way, we now have confirmation that what was going on in Gaza, there were frameworks, Hamas and people in Gaza had accepted these frameworks. And Biden killed him. I don't, in some ways, yeah, he's not prisoner, but Biden, Blinken, and the rest, Biden, Blinken, I think are the main characters there, really have created like this perfect storm that played right into Trump's hands. And to this day, but they haven't learned. They should have seen that Gaza was killing it. We told them, like, how many of us said that? Like, how many, like thousands of people every day were saying, like, this is going to kill you. You're going to lose the election because of Gaza. They didn't listen. And in the same way, we said Ukraine's a bloodbath, and they didn't listen, and they haven't changed. They lost the election. They've been shrieking about fascism for a decade. Now they're just like watching it happen. And their advice per James Tarville is, don't do anything and let Trump blow himself up.
Play dead.
And then, oh, fuck, the war will be over when he finally, it's unreal. But again, when I say we, I'm not talking about me and you personally or the smartest guys in the room. It's just like, collectively, there is a big group of people like us out there who are aware of this stuff and been talking about it for a long time. And we get blamed, right? The other day I saw all these great, brilliant political scientists saying, like, the Democrats have to become more moderate. How do you become more moderate than supporting a genocide? Like, you support a genocide. That's extreme. That's like extreme left, right? That's in their minds. When they talk about the left, that's who they're talking about. People who are protesting against Israel or protesting against COVID. And we're the extremists. We don't want the pandemics and genocide to extreme in American media landscape today. God damn it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
It's awful. I don't know, but hopefully the war ends. Trump's going to get rich off of it. That's what always happens, right? People get rich at the end of the wars.
Yeah.
The usual suspects will dive in, especially Reconstruction. Whenever you talk about Reconstruction, there's so much money to be made.
Yeah.
American corporations will dash in there. And before long, there'll be Starbucks and Kiev and Pilates studios and spas and McDonald's and whatever else, right? Trump hotels.
Yeah, I'm sure there's plans for those.
Trump Bibles, the Trump Riviera, right? Who does that? Who puts up fucking videos of Trump? Who does that? The guy is like embracing ethnic cleansing. He's embracing crimes against humanity. Yeah. They get away with everything. It's just amazing, right? They're on the fence, right? And the governor of New York is canceling academic positions, and they're putting kids in jail for protesting against the wars, and they're beating the shit out of people at public meetings who dare question the local authorities.
Eve Engler is now in jail.
He's finally out.
Yeah, is he out?
He was
in
jail. Yeah. But yeah, he's like going, trying to, I think he may take action against them. There were no charges or anything, nothing after 5 days, right? One of the people beaten up recently was an ex-NFL player. He was speaking out at a city council meeting in California. They beat the hell out of him. Yeah. That woman, where was it, Idaho or one of those states, right?
It was in Idaho.
Yeah, and these campuses, these are suspending students, arresting students.
I think that's a good important point to make, too, is that liberals are you making a big deal about this woman who got zip tied and taken out of this Republican congressman's town hall or whatever for asking questions about Medicaid, I believe is what happened.
So, yeah.
And some people who did not identify themselves as police, didn't seem like they were police, or maybe one of the three were like zip tied her and took her out. Right. Yeah. That's pretty fucking crazy. That's pretty bad. But how is that different than what, you know, college administrators are doing to students at Barnard College or in CSU Long Beach is actually another place where we've seen that sort of stuff. Or that's happened in any number of places around Gaza. And yet the same people who like are going nuts about what happened in Idaho, which I agree is really bad and really scary, also happening on liberal colleges by liberal administrators in liberal cities or liberal mayors. It's really important to note though, like there's an anti-authoritarian spirit, I still believe, in this country on the left, and people are just very confused about where they should be in this mix, because they somehow think that the Democratic establishment is somehow anti-authoritarian because they're up against Trump, which is actually really problematic.
No, the Democrats really laid the groundwork for all this. There's a survey yesterday. Only 33% of Democrats currently have a favorable attitude about Israel. As of 5 or 6 years ago, that was like 70-some percent. So the Democratic Party has destroyed, I mean, themselves internally, right? Their own people now reject their position on Israel and defeated them. They made Trump, the Democrats made Trump happen twice, really.
They have a 20% approval rating of the Democratic Party at this point.
That high?
Yeah. Exactly. There's nowhere to go.
What can you say good about him? I think Bernie Sanders, what he's doing is laudable, right? Going out to a lot of these red areas and fucking about the oligarchy. That's cool. And Murphy and Pritzker have said some stuff, but really, they're on a morphine drip, right? They're on life support. And they're going to induce coma or something like that. I don't know.
Team Jeffries came out and said that Andrew Cuomo would be the great next mayor of New York. Basically,
Kim Jeffries was upset the other day. He said, "The left attacks me instead of Trump. You're in the way, motherfucker. This guy is out there. He's out there, like these like Manhattan and San Francisco, raising tens of millions of dollars, while Bernie Sanders is in like Iowa, Nebraska. So they haven't learned. They don't want to learn. They're never gonna. The idea that they're gonna learn something. When this goes to the whole obsession with elections, degrees. I feel the same way about them now." Like, I get the two parties suck, but the Green Party is useless too. All they're doing is saying, you need to vote green. You need to get the Green Party on the ballot. That's all you need. We're that close. And all we need to do is vote green. Jesus Christ. You know, look, some of these town meetings, we've seen people come out, which is great. And hopefully, I get the sense those things are just being, I don't know, are there local people organizing those, like unions, or are people just showing up because they're pissed off?
I think the ones I've seen, that's a big strategy of Indivisible, which was a group that came together in early 2017, where they would go and, you know, agitprop at these town hall meetings. So I wouldn't be surprised if they were behind some of that.
Yeah.
I saw one where it's a lot of federal workers. So maybe it's the federal worker unions also.
Well,
turning them out to this stuff as well.
Actually, they got 10,000 new members. I believe it was AFGE since Trump started firing people. That's, in fact, the Republicans have actually said, I think they're probably not going to have any more of those town meetings. Some people said, we have to quit doing it, right? Because we can't actually go out and talk to people. And what's amazing is like, they kick
people should just go to their offices at that point then.
Well, yeah, that's what you have to do, right? They kick people out. They kick media out and they get away with it, right? It's amazing. Yeah, they're so craven and gutless, these people. Bezos, you always knew that. I think what's funny about Bezos is he said, we're going to focus on two things. Well, it's personal liberty and economic liberty and personal freedom. Right? What the hell do you think they're doing now? That's what the media does. Why does he have to be open about it? That's what they do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So Go ahead.
No, I was
going to say. I got the one last thing we're going to do.
Yeah, so. That's me too. But no, the one thing I got to say is like, The last several years have been instructive, I think, in finding out the people who run the country, like a lot of them, they're not very smart, which is encouraging. But when you get a glimpse and you really look at these people, look, they're not smart. Elon Musk is not a smart guy. Trump is a fucking idiot. Of course, Trump is insane. He's an idiot. But they're thankfully, they're not that bright, because they would be way more dangerous if they were.
Yeah, that's true. It's very true. They're clownish supervillains. They're not Lex Luthor. We're going to close today.
I'll peace to Gene Hackman.
Yeah. Yeah. Big tribute to Gene Hackman.
You mentioned, didn't he play Lex Luthor? Wasn't
he? He did play Lex Luthor in the 1970s.
That's why I thought you said it. Yeah.
We should do it. We'll have a little art and culture section episode soon on Gene Hackman. Now I'm thinking about it. This was a episode mostly about military and war in Ukraine. There was another, besides the anniversary, the 3-year anniversary of the war in Ukraine, another anniversary was this week too, which was the self-immolation death of Aaron Bushnell, which we actually did an episode on last year when it happened with our friend, anti-war vet, anti-capitalist vet, Grant Klumpner. But we just wanted to pay a little tribute to Aaron Bushnell to close out today's episode. And I am going to read actually what his final message was, and then maybe we'll say a couple of things as well. His final message was, "My name is Aaron Bushnell, and I am an active duty member of the United States Air Force. I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest. But compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal." And then when he actually did the actual self-immolation, his last words were, "Free Palestine." I'll salute to Aaron Bushnell, who...
Yeah, we need to know more about him. Norman Morrison, the Vietnam era, did that. And there are places in Vietnam, like streets and center, community centers and things named after Norman Morrison. And Fadi was telling me, and like in Yemen, there are like all kinds of signs about Aaron Bushnell. But here in the U.S., we need to really be aware of what he did and think about that, because what he did is very powerful.
Yeah. I always feel hard when I see graffiti and murals from different parts of the world with Aaron Bushnell on them. Folks, you've been listening to the Green and Red podcast, talking about war and peace and profit and loss, I guess you might say. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to us on any of the podcast audio platforms, give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button, or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And until we speak again, everybody go out and make trouble and misbehave, because it's all we got at this point. And if you do, let us know, because we'd love to talk to you. And we'll catch you again soon. Bye.
Were you trying to get crazy with this, eh? Don't you know I'm loco? I'm thinking it's all over when I go out drinking.